Okay, today is, what is today's date? Oh, it's Pesach part 2, 5775. That's what it is, whatever it is. It's Erev Pesach.
Very close.
It's the week of Erev Pesach.
Part 1, yeah.
So last week we did part 1. This week, we're not going to so much look at the sheet that I gave out last week, but we're going to look at the packet that I gave out last week. Which is the Rav Dessler sheets. Now, before I do that, I just want to do a few notes that I put on Marlon's packet. Right, so you can just remind me what they are.
Would you like the notes?
Okay, I'll say the notes and then I'll give you them. Okay, so it's interesting. So I've just learned a few words. I enjoy Rav Shalom Rosner's shiurim. So I was listening to his, he has a few different ones on the Haggadah, which are very interesting. And what he does each year, and he has like 14 of them, is he just goes through the entire Haggadah and he says a thought on each part of it. So that each year it builds on another. He keeps track, so he's, you know, each year it's a different thought on each part.
So. And then you have to remember from last year?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Or you can listen to his recording.
Lisa, look at the date. England, 1944.
Yes.
Right. She was talking about that, right?
Yes.
Well, she was saying that.
But this is Rav Dessler. Yeah, we'll talk about Rav Dessler soon.
He did this when he was. This is the one you said.
Rav Dessler was separated, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, right.
Apart
from
his spouse.
Yeah.
Or
for a long time, yeah. Right, so he was, he was not single. I think he was separated from his wife.
That's what you said, thought. Because she was stuck behind the.
She was stuck. Yeah, they were where did they live? I don't know, on the other side of Europe, on the bad part. And he went to England for fundraising, and then he got stuck. The war broke out, and he was stuck. And they were separate for years. He was separate. Yeah, they had a daughter and a son, so he was separated from the three: his wife, daughter, and son, for all those years. And they probably maybe they would have had more kids. Who knows? You know, like, but they were separated for a long, long time. I think like a decade, close to a decade, or at least several years. Long.
And she said he wrote. She
I think so, because I think, but I don't remember exactly. But I think maybe his wife and kids maybe went to Australia. Maybe they escaped
to Australia.
I think so. And then he went to Israel.
After the war ended,
I don't think they so easily got back together.
Because 44 was but we don't know that this was the beginning of the separation.
Well, that's true.
Right. He may have. No, I think the separation was a little
30s,
earlier.
38. Right.
Yeah, I think it was earlier. Yeah. And then I think probably it took some time to get back together. It cost money. You know, nothing is free. We're just so not used to it because we have so much more money today. Even people who don't have money have so much more money today. It's hard to understand what it was really like to not have money.
Or settle living.
You know, just we don't understand what it's like to not have. Like I have a friend, had a friend. She was in her mid-90s in the late 80s. Anyway, she told me once in 94, she said, I really need a new dress. I said, why don't you get one? She said, it's not worth it. I'm not going to get enough wear out of it. So she wasn't going to get a new dress because she didn't think she was going to live that long. Why should she bother? But in 96, she told me, now I really need a new dress. I should have bought it when I was 94. I said, why didn't you buy it? She said, now it's really not worth it. I was thinking, she was raised in such a different world where you only buy a dress if you need it and you expect to get wear. It's not our world. Where you go, like, for fun to buy a new shirt, and if it's not going to be in style next year, you're not worried about it. So, what do you see? I want to know what you're seeing that's interesting.
Cumin.
Oh, cumin. Are they putting that as kidney oat?
Cumin is, that's weird.
Seed.
Yeah.
Or
but it's
ground.
Not a, but it's...
It's a seed, but can it rise?
Also coriander.
No. It's kidney oat. It's kidney oat.
And coriander is
kidney oat also, I guess.
Which
don't
is
make flour.
No, but coriander is a
Well, mustard also. No, it's not about the expansion.
Well, mustard is another reason.
Well, they're all look at
dill.
Anise. I don't like anise, so I don't care whether it's good or not. I don't like it.
What's
I don't like it.
But quinoa is allowed.
Yes. As of a few years ago, that was like a magical appearance.
Right.
Dill, though, that's. Oh, dill seed.
Seeds.
Well,
again,
seeds.
It's all seeds.
It's a seed.
But I did, a couple of years ago, I called about sunflower seeds, and they're fine.
Right, so it's not all seeds that are problems. It's certain seeds that, yeah, so, and it really depends on, I don't think you have to take this 100%. I think you should ask your
human just seemed like a weird one to me, that's all.
You can get kosher l'pesach cumin. Okay. Now the question is that within our, I say our Ashkenazic tradition,
somebody's.
I think there's narrower Ashkenazic traditions than others.
Gotcha.
So that's why you have to ask your person, what do you hold by? Like, for instance, our Ashkenazic family eats me'ain kitniot. So me'ain kitniot is kitniot derivatives. You can't buy that in this country.
Oh, you can only buy it in Israel.
You can only buy it in Israel, because they used to sell it in this country. So me'ain kitniot would be corn oil or
something from
kitniot. Right,
well,
right.
You always use peanut oil when you still have it.
Peanuts are kosher l'Pesach. And they always
use
peanut oil.
But they're not.
But they don't say that anymore. Today they don't. If you see Rav Moshe Feinstein, he has some, he talks about when he was a little boy, one of the Pesach treats was peanuts.
Uh-huh.
Not peanut oil, peanuts. Mm. Yeah.
Because they're not a legume.
They're not a
And I thought they were.
No, I think they are
a legume.
Ellie, it says sunflower seed should not be used.
Well, see,
so that's
she
what I'm telling
to her, but she
so that's what I'm saying.
Rabbi.
So that's
rabbi
why this
Frank one.
She so, talked to her rabbi.
Right. So you have to go by your rug because there's different things that are. So, of course, nobody
about pumpkin seed.
Nobody says chametz is okay, right? Chametz is not okay.
We got that.
And now the question is, what is kitniot?
Right.
And who? So
well, that's sort of how quinoa came into being okay.
Right, because it's not kitniot. Right. So, but what is kitniot? And I think there's a lot of different definitions
right.
for what is kitniot. And I think that depends on the region from which your family comes in Europe. So it really depends on each person's...
Because I think of coriander is like parsley. I mean, it's like...
You know. Coriander leaves?
Yeah, that's what I meant, yeah.
Did it say you shouldn't use that? Coriander should not be used. Coriander
seeds.
It doesn't say seeds, it just says coriander.
It just says, yeah, see, that's why.
But where do you buy coriander leaves?
Coriander is a powder.
That's isn't that
I have them because I dry them and I dry them in the, summer from growing them and then I
coriander.
Absolutely yeah well coriander is yeah
is yes cilantro.
Cilantro yes coriander thank you
yes
coriander is
cilantro
and I use cilantro
yeah. So
right,
might mean
right,
the seeds
it,
the seeds are a different flavor than the leaves
right
yeah. Anyway, yeah, so there's all kinds of stuff, and you just
Sorry,
have to ask your own...
Attention.
Yeah, you have to ask your own rabbi for your own minhag, like how it works in your family, because there's such wide variations. Okay, so karpas.
Okay, back to the subject,
right,
sorry.
Right. Karpas. So there's just an interesting thought here, and I think that this ties in, and I recommend very highly, you look up alephbeta.org. What? Rabbi David Foreman, Aleph Beta.
Oh, Aleph.
ALEPHBETA.org. Rabbi David Foreman. He has several series of videos, short, like 10-minute videos in the series. So one is a series of six that talks about slavery. Why did we need slavery? He says, here we are, thanking God for taking us out of slavery, but he's the one who put us into it. He even promised he would. Like, what's up with that? Like, does anybody ever stop to ask that question? You know, we're like, thank you for taking us out.
And why did you put us in?
Yeah. Look,
we know that.
Right, right. So that needs to be discussed. So I didn't get all the way to the end, and I don't remember his reason from other years. Obviously, we do need whatever is coming from this and difficult things that come. Hashem shapes our worlds for us so that we get to where we need to be. But on the top, just one aspect of it, of how we got into slavery. So how did we actually get to Egypt?
Oh. Famine.
Famine. That was... Okay, how did we get into slavery?
I mean...
Yosef,
yeah,
right.
Yosef.
The sale of Yosef
right.
is what
yeah,
brought us into slavery, right?
Right.
That's what brought us in.
He was the...
Right, but it's the sale Christ of Yosef right. that brought us in. So it seems that the coat of many colors, right, that kutonet pasim, was an instigating event, or certainly a symbolic of the beginning of the end, right? So we have that, and what happened with that coat? That coat was dipped in blood and used to trick Dad,
right? Dad, right.
Now, it's interesting, Rabbi Foreman points out, if you think about the coat dipped in goat blood, what other incident of coats and goats and tricking Dad were there?
Mm-hmm. No, Isaac.
Right.
Excellent.
Right.
Excellent. Isaac wearing a coat of goat.
Yeah. Coat of goat.
A coat of goat to trick,
to trick
his father.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got the one who did the tricking is now being tricked. with the same vehicle. That's right. Yep.
Measure for measure.
Yeah.
So it comes around.
Yeah. So it does seem like it's a very interesting parallel, and he talks about how there's strong parallels in those two stories, but that it was the coat that was dipped in the blood that tricked Dad that sent us into Egypt. So he says Karpas could be reminiscent of the Kutonet Pasim, the coat of many colors, Karpas. So you don't have the resh, so where does the resh go? But Karpas, Kutonet Pasim. And you dip it in the salt water. Dip in the salt water, of course, we can't eat blood, but we're saying this thing that was dipped, it is the dipping of something that caused us a lot of tsuris. And the faking out, and that's what brought us in. So we're remembering that. Well, that's one of the things that we're remembering when we dip the Karpas into salt water, is the dipping of the coats into the coat into the blood. But he also talks about let's think about the Korban Pesach for a minute. How did they get the Korban Pesach home? Everybody goes to the Beis HaMikdash, slaughters their Korban Pesach, and then they have to schlep it dead from the Beis HaMikdash. They probably walked to the Beis HaMikdash on a leash, right? And then to get it back, it's not walking anymore.
Probably.
Over your shoulders, but what are you carrying it in? They didn't have like garbage bags or. Right?
So the blood,
the blood dripped on the.
So they said they carried it in the skin. They peeled the skin off.
Oh, and they wrapped it in the skin.
And then they wrapped it in the skin and slung it over their back and carried it to their hotel room where they're going to make the Seder.
Okay.
Let me just remind you of this point, which is so important to remember. How much Korban Pesach do you have to eat?
Olives
and arthritic, because that's it.
But don't you have to finish the whole thing?
You have to finish the whole thing.
So unless you really have a lot of people, you're going to have to eat more than that.
That's correct.
Big family.
You have to finish the whole thing, which means you have to invite a lot of people because it's after the meal.
Excuse us, we're having a
crisis. Okay, you don't have to today, but if you had the Korban Pesach, you would have to.
Never been uninvited, never mind. Go, move on.
You have to have a large Seder if you think about how it works, because everybody has to get together. You can't invite last minute. You know, the whole thing that we say at the Seder, everyone who's hungry, come and eat,
right,
can't work at all, because for Pesach, you have to invite beforehand, because you have to all coordinate who's bringing the Korban Pesach for our group, who's in our group.
You have to set the table.
You have to set the table, for sure, but you have to, before that, you have to plan the Korban Pesach, and everybody has to pay into that Korban Pesach, and then somebody is appointed, the shaliach, and they're sent, and they shecht it, and they bring it back, and the whole thing has to be finished down to the last bite, which means you have to have enough people at your Seder that after all that matzah, and after the marah, and after the meal, you'll polish off the entire animal. Right, so unless you have a pack of teenage boys.
Small animal.
That's right. So they're
small animals.
Small animals, nevertheless, it's still quite a bit to eat after you've eaten everything. So it's something for us to think about what it might have been like at that time and how many people actually did sit around.
Well, and meat was not a big part of their diet, so that was like a big deal for them to be having
right.
all that.
Right. It had to be roasted.
It was super expensive. And
Right. And it's interesting because it has to be roasted and not boiled. We do the opposite today. We make sure that we don't roast for the Seder so that it shouldn't look like a carbon. But the roasting concentrates the meat and makes the flavors more concentrated and more delicious. But it makes it smaller, too.
I was going to say.
As opposed to, let's say, cholent, where you just put in a little bit of meat and it expands. Mm-hmm. And the whole cholent is meat-flavored, even if there's not that much meat in it. It's the most economic use of meat possible to put it in a stew like that. So we don't want to be economic, we want to be royalty.
But remind me again, since the Korban Pesach was roasted, why can't we roast?
We don't roast because we don't want anybody to confuse that there's no Korban.
We don't have a Korban.
We don't have a Korban. So there's no roast. We don't even roast poultry, that's our thing. That's our minhag, is to not roast at all. For the Seders, you can roast any other type of Pesach, but not for the Seders. So, and we do usually roast the zroa, whatever the zroa is.
Bone,
we got a little lamb
egg.
Bone, or we got the egg for sure, but the bone is the problem. We roast the bone.
We always roast the bone.
Right, we roast the bone, and we put it on the Seder plate.
Right.
But we're careful when we say Pesach Matzah Mor, we don't point to the Pesach. We don't point to that, but we point to the matzah and we point to the mar. We don't point to Pesach when we say Pesach. When we say, these are the three things you need to have said in order to make this Seder kosher, Pesach, matzah, mar. So we sit there with our hands in our laps, Pesach, matzah, mar. We point to the other two, but we do not.
We don't want it to be
that
like
is
that,
not,
Pesach.
That is not our sacrifice.
Even
that is not
roasted.
Right. Even though we roasted it, we don't want anybody to confuse and think that that is a piece of the carbon, because we don't have a carbon, so, and we don't roast our meat, so nobody should think that there's a carbon.
If you had the base of Mikdash, would you have?
If you had the base of Mikdash, you would have a carbon, right? And then you wouldn't have a little bone on your plate.
You'd have the whole lamb.
You'd have the whole animal.
You try to find one at Costco, kosher yet.
Yeah, well, if you go to Restaurant Depot, you can get the whole halal goats.
A halal goat.
But has anybody decided yet that that's
kosher? No, halal is not kosher by any standard at all whatsoever anywhere on the planet. Nevertheless.
Gee, are you sure?
Positive. Especially having a husband who is an attorney for many kosher meat places and has worked with halal. There's zero standards. It's unbelievable.
Really?
Nothing like kosher.
Oh, they have no specific ways?
Yeah, they do. They just don't keep them at all.
Oh. So they have them, it's just not observed. Gotcha.
They barely have them and they don't observe what they have. Like, gotcha. You know, there's certain levels, but you could just play a recording of Allahu Akbar while people shecht.
And
they don't even have to shecht. They can use a pocket knife and saw. It just has to be in that certain spot. But it could not even be that. So the way it works in the kosher plants is they have the recording playing, and they have the kosher guy do the shechita, and then they have a Muslim guy come in after that with his knife. After it's properly shechted, the Muslim guy just takes his knife and touches it inside, and that's called halal.
That makes it
halal. Mm-hmm. So that the hindquarters are the ones that turn out to not be kosher because the lungs are something, so then they're all halal, and that can
and
be sold for halal.
That.
Yeah, that can be sold for halal. But that's actually a relatively high level because that is all shechted properly. Mm-hmm. But some places have the recording playing. Really, you're supposed to say it. That's the high level. But some places just have the recording playing while they're stunning in stun factories. And then after they're stunned or shot with the whatever they how they do that, then they just cut. They make a symbolic cut.
Which
sort of isn't what killed
the whole point.
Right. And they're calling that halal.
Right.
So, yeah. So, this whatever. They have their own standards. They can do their own thing. But we don't hold by that at all. But they do hold by us. Okay, so that's the ketonet passing. And okay, so that was one thing that was interesting that Rabbi Rasner pointed out is that carrying it over your shoulder like that, he said, is like the Yishmaeli merchants. Right? So like the Arab merchants. Mm-hmm. That's what they looked like. Why should we think about the Yishmaeli merchants? Because sold into slavery and he sold to the Ishmaelim, and we have to recognize that was our ancestors who caused this whole thing. We're that's part of the reliving of it. Is we're enacting this thing where we have to recognize it's the coats, the goats, the we sold into slavery. We are now we want to be God's servants, but we schlep this over our back to like the Ishmaelim, just back like there's little pieces that have to do with the whole thing that we want to say. We want to take responsibility. Anyway, I thought that was interesting just to think about how does it, because we often don't think, how did they actually do it? We don't think the whole thing through. You know, they went, they chose the animal, they brought the animal. You know, what was it like to stand online, you know, and wait for your animal to be shechted? Who are you chatting with? What was that conversation like? Did you have to go to the mikveh first? Into which level can you go? Like, all these different things that had to be taken care of.
Could women go to get the goat?
Could they go to the Beit HaMikdash to have it sacrificed? I don't know.
Or could they go to buy it?
To buy it, probably.
Maybe. Could they go to...
I don't know. Right, so those are all great questions. Yeah, I don't know all those. It would be interesting to think.
Probably like, nobody knows.
Head of the household? I'm sure somebody who knows the halachas knows. Like, who can bring it in? How tahor do you have to be? To what inner sanctum of the sanctuary? Do you have to bring it in order to do it?
Or does the high priest take it and come bring it back?
Right.
Or a priest?
Right, a priest.
Bring it back.
And I think you can do it yourself. I think you can shecht it. I think this is one that you can shecht yourself in the Beis HaMikdash if you know how to do it. Or you can hire a kohen to do it for you if you don't know how to do it. Same thing as a bris. You don't have to have them all do it.
Yeah.
You don't. It's so interesting. I don't know if you saw that IJN. that had interviewed, I think, 8 Mo'alim, or 7 Mo'alim and 1 Mohelet. Yeah, 1 Mohelet. So I interviewed them, but it asked them each the same question. And one, I mean, several questions, but all the same was interesting. So one of the questions was, what was your most memorable bris? Yeah. Right? So one of them said, he brised a Russian grown-up man, came from Russia, hadn't been brised yet. And it happened a lot, men coming from Russia, and they got their brises. Mm-hmm. And they have to be extra brave for that in your 30s, 40s, 50s to get your bris. So this man, so the mole set him up, was all ready for the bris, all ready for the cut, when the man himself grabbed the scalpel to do the cut himself. And he said, I do it myself, like Avraham Avinu. And he did it himself. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be memorable.
Yeah, so that was his most memorable bris.
For a man too.
Right?
No anesthesia?
I think there may have been some. I think for adults they do have some. Yeah. But still.
Oh.
Yeah. I know. Okay, so that was the karpas that I wanted to talk about.
Like giving myself shots.
Right. Now let's just talk about lechem oni for 1 minute. So lechem oni, of course, the classic joke at our table in the name of Grandpa Hellerman, Alav Hashalom, is that it's called lechem oni because it makes you poor. It's the bread of affliction, but buying it because it costs $32 a pound or whatever matzah is, ridiculous. It's called lechem oni because it makes you poor. But it's called lechem oni because it's the bread of affliction, so that's what poor people ate, plain old, boring old bread like that. But it's also called lechem oni. What else is the root oni? Besides ani, which is poor, oni.
An oni is a person.
A poor person, but it's also la'anot. So oni is poor, ani is poor, oni is affliction, so it's bread of affliction. But la'anot is to answer, it's the bread of answers. So it's also called the bread that we onanim alav harbe, we answer upon it a lot. So we use that bread to create questions. Right, so we talked about before the relationship between the word answer and the word affliction, because they're the same root, answer and affliction, except for one's pal and one's peel. So pal is the soft term, like shavar is break, and peel is the intense form, like shiber, which means to shatter. Right? So break to shatter is answer to afflict. So how does that work? So answer my question, la'anot. But affliction is oni, that's super answering. That's where all your whole being is caused to answer all the time. You're in such answering mode that you can't ever ask.
Isn't that kind of where aestheticism comes?
Aestheticism, yeah.
Aestheticism,
yeah.
You know, that you afflict yourself to get answers.
Oh, I don't.
Thought it was like a super denial thing where you're.
It is a super denial. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Aestheticism is it is an affliction. So there's the afflicting yourself. That's like on Yom Kippur when they says afflict yourself. Yeah. And it's the same word. Va'anisam es nafshotecham for Yom Kippur. But here, it's the idea is that the super answering is the affliction. You're in answer mode so much to your master that you can't ever ask. I mean, all you can ask is if they say jump, you could say how high, but you can never say why. What's the purpose of jumping? Right? You're only asking, how shall I do that for you? That's it. That's what oni is. That's what affliction is you just, I mean, think about the slaves in the South, which was, I think probably was similar to the Egyptian slavery in that sense. I also, Rabbi Foreman, such interesting stuff. He talks about, well, what's up with the snake and the staff? Like, why is that? Like, how is that a sign at all? So he talks about how, in order to destroy people, in order for there to be genocide, and to get all the neighbors to agree to kill everyone, you have to dehumanize them. You have to bring them to a place where you're not killing humans, you're killing vermin. So that certainly happened in the Holocaust. So, but that's what the snake sign was about. He said, cast them down and make them into vermin, right? That's what they did to the Jews, and that's what they, because when it says,
and then you don't feel like,
and then you don't feel it. It says, and they, and that's the language that they use when it says they increased harbei v'yishratzu v'yirbu. They yishratzu is a word. They expanded and they increased, but the language that's used is like how cockroaches increase.
Just sort of
like
multiply,
they just they multiplied like vermin, like creepy crawly things like snakes. Right? Because snakes are the king of the creepy crawlies. Right? So they multiplied like scary things. They were creepy. And it uses animal language when discussing the Jews' multiplication. And so so he says what they did was they cast the Jews down to make them like vermin. And so Moshe, in order to show the Jews, right, because the question at the burning bush was, what if they don't believe me? Not if they don't believe you exist. What if they don't believe in your message? Like, they don't get it. So God is saying, here, I'm going to tell you some signs that these signs will let them know, I see who they are, I get it. I am God. I see their affliction. Cast your stick down, mate. Mate means your stick. It also is the same word for tribe. Mate, right? Cast the tribe down. Make it into a snake. That's what they did. But you'll see, you could just pick it right back up.
Yeah, but
and it's actually
Egyptian
a staff.
They
could do it too. They could do it too. So that's why you need another sign, right? I didn't get to what the white hand means yet. But the blood one is, pour the blood, take the water from the Nile and pour it on. It'll turn into blood. And that's also for God to show, I get what you're going through. Rabbi Foreman says, this is an interesting therapy point. You know, somebody who's abused, think about if you've ever known, unfortunately, an abused wife or somebody in an abused relationship, they don't always get that they're being abused. Or even if they do, they think it's their fault. Or
they have explanations, justifications.
They do, or they think they deserve it, or they think that really that person, the abuser, is not so bad. Or if they get out of it, they feel like nobody knows. Nobody knows what I'm doing. They're not. It's not just secretive, but like everybody sees him as nice. Mm. You know, like nobody knows what he's like. So part of the redemption from that abuse is for other people to see what he's like. If he can get arrested and put in jail, then everybody knows you were the one in the right. You're not making up stories. You're right. He's wrong. Right, he's in jail now. So that's what pouring the blood was, is that the worst thing the Egyptians did to the Jews was kill their babies. Not even the work without paying, that's bad. But to rip their babies out of their arms and drown them in the river, how terrible is that? And the river, the lifeblood of Egypt, right? It's a big river. Why would they do that? Because it doesn't affect the river. The river, you know, it absorbs all that blood, all those babies, and it looks just fine. Peaceful and sunny and lovely. It still waters the crops. You can still sunbathe. You can still swim. It's still beautiful the whole time. And so the river's not telling the story, right? So the Jews are thinking, how could you? And the Egyptians are like, could what? Everything's fine. Look at the river. Beautiful and shiny. Mm-hmm. So to take a little bit of that water out of the river and pour it on the ground and
show
the blood is saying, God saying, it's God saying, I see it and I know exactly what happened. Look what that water is. It's bloody water. So that was part of the letting them know. Not because obviously they believe in God. It's just letting them know that God gets them, that there's something to believe in the relationship, that you can trust the relationship. That's what the emunah is, the aminu. Okay, and finally, one more thought right now is, Manishtana Halayla Hazeh. I'll pass this back so I remember in my thoughts. Thank you. So it can be both a question and a statement. Like we have in Psalms, Ma Rabu Ma'asecha. How great are your wonders, Hashem? But we start that with Ma, how great are. It's not how great are your wonders. We're just wondering how great are they. Right? That's not what it is, but it's stated the same way, Ma Rabu Ma'asecha. So when you say Ma Nishtana, it might not be a question, it might be a statement. How different is this night from other nights? It's so different. So one interpretation of that night is Gullus, is exile. How different is this exile from all our other exiles? Look how long it is. Look how difficult it is. It's so different than any other of the exiles that we experienced before. They were shorter. They were much more single-faceted than this one, which is so multifaceted. Now we can look around us and just see scary things all around us. I think this could speak to us more than any other time in my Jewish memory, anyway, in the last 35 years. There's scary stuff happening. I heard somebody speak, and I wondered, because I think I mentioned last time, Netanyahu was attacked by somebody who said they're the Satmar Rebbe. Maybe it was the Satmar Rebbe, maybe it wasn't. But nevertheless, because I'd like to give the Satmar Rebbe that benefit of the doubt, because what was written in his name was so ugly. But the point is, some Jew believed that because somebody wrote it. Somebody wrote it. Whether it was him or one of his followers or somebody who thought it sounded right. and said terrible things about Netanyahu, just awful. And I was thinking, why can't that, like, we need unity. That's what we need. Why can't he say, okay, he has different pathways than me, but what we both care about is the survival of the Jewish people. Let's focus on that and how to do that, right? Let's at least partner that we both care. So, okay, so that was my thought there. But then I heard somebody speak, I heard a clip of a woman speaking at the J Street conference, and I thought, how could I partner with her? I don't see a way at all whatsoever. I mean, first of all, she contradicted herself in saying that, you know, Israel is not a democracy. 20% of its population, bless you, is oppressed, and they make up the third biggest political party now. I'm thinking, wait a second.
That's the same. Then how are they
oppressed? And how is it not actually a democracy? It is the third largest political party, which seems like that might have been. But anyway, then she said, Israel should accept. Oh, and then she goes on to say that, you know, she understands the oppression of the Palestinians. I mean, here we came and we took their land from them. We displaced them. And there's still a people looking for a place in the world. And we need to give it to them. We should accept protected minority status and make Israel into a true democracy. And that's still Zionistic. Because the Zionist dream is not necessarily establishing a Jewish state, but rather having a safe homeland for the Jewish people. And as protected minorities, they could still be safe. And I'm thinking, safe because in every other Arab country, they've been a safe, protected minority? I mean, like, that's the Ya'aminu. Like,
Where are the Jews in Yemen?
We have an emunah. That is based on reality that we've learned over the years that, no, there's no such thing as protected minority. It just doesn't work. But to say that was Zionistic. And so, anyway, she said so many things like that, and everybody around her is nodding her head and giving her applause.
You think she was saying that the Jews could live in a land and be a protected minority?
She was saying the Jews need to give up their desire to be in charge of the state. We're oppressors, and we have to stop oppressing. This state should be a Muslim-run state because that is the area, and we should take our proper status as protected minority. Wow. We would be the protected minority. And she got wild applause for this.
Who will press
this? This is the J Street platform. I mean, wild applause, right? She was on the J Street, you know, she was on the dais, and everybody around her is nodding their heads, and she got, many times it was broken with applause for what she's saying.
Scary.
Yeah. So I'm looking at her thinking, how can I share anything with her? You know, here's a Jewish woman, and I'm thinking, okay, we both want good for the Jews. No, we don't. We don't both want good for the Jews. She's so far off that she doesn't, right? And that's my segue into this beginning of the of Dessa that we want to look at. I really think she's lost it. I mean, let's look at this verse here in the first of the Rav Dessler articles that we have. If the Holy One, blessed be He, had not taken us out of Egypt, the result would have been that we, our children and grandchildren, would be subject to Paro in Mitzrayim. So, Paro in Mitzrayim. Paro, we talked about the word Paro last time, para, is actually wild or broken open. That Paro's, it's interesting to see broken open and Mitzrayim together. In a way, it's a contradiction. Mitzrayim meaning narrow straits or constriction, a place from which no one ever escaped. And Paro, which means broken open or wild, but Paro's objective was to break open people's boundaries so that the Yetzirah would have complete control, in a sense, right? So once those boundaries were so broken open, then there is no going back. That's why we had to be taken out right then. We had already gotten down to the 49th level of Tumah, and if Hashem wouldn't have taken us out at that moment, we would have succumbed, and we would have still been slaves. There would have been nothing left to redeem because we would have been so broken open. in that narrow place. So let's talk about broken open and how narrow it is. So how does freedom lead to entrapment? That kind of freedom lead to entrapment. And I think about it.
Well, I'll tell you what I see this right now. And I look at, okay, so we're not slaves. And now we have freedom to intermarry. We have freedom to assimilate. We have freedom to just... move into the society.
Let's talk about freedom to intermarry for a minute, because that's a place that's leading into entrapment right now. Leading into entrapment. I'm serious, because we do have that freedom. But we're not there yet, but in some circles we are there. Hello. Thank you very much. You too. In some circles already, people can't say anything against it because it's seen as racist. It's seen as exclusionary, and we're not that. And so we won't say anything against it, which means not only is there the freedom to, there is not the freedom to only date Jewish in some circles. It's not even the freedom. It's, we're moving into a place where people will say, I'm going to, not just should I limit my marriage pool. And they're not even saying that. They're saying, I am not the kind of person that will look upon somebody else's religion and exclude them from my life in that way. Right. That's the wrong. So I'm saying we're moving into the transition where in some circles people are trapped by that freedom. They
half
are.
Half of us at
they
this
are.
Table have that in our families where
yes,
you don't want to wildly say.
Right, yes. Right, so you wouldn't say it.
Say
it doesn't mean that you would condone it. If my son would do that, I would be very, very upset.
Yeah, but also some people wouldn't. Some people, first of all, wouldn't be upset, but other people would know they can't. They're now trapped from saying anything, even if they would be upset. And some people have been called on
was
the
it
carpet.
Political correctness?
Yes, yeah, that's what I'm saying. We're moving into a place of political correctness where people are trapped by that freedom. That now you can't say anything against it. And already some people have been called on the carpet at Hillel's and other places like that for saying anything about you should marry Jewish. You can't say that anymore in some circles. You can't. So that's what I'm saying. We're not fully there yet, but we are moving from freedom to entrapment in that sense.
Well, and the flip of it is, you know, there are still some families that take those children and wipe them off. I mean,
some, not too many, not but there are some. But there's a very big difference between saying we're extremely disappointed and we wish they never had, and we don't feel that we can accept the spouse, and they can't come over, but our child still can. There's a very big difference between that and saying that you can't mention it at all whatsoever. You know, and in fact, you can flip it, and that's what's happening. The flip into it's not Jewish to be so provincial. Right, like what this woman did is saying Zionism is realized by becoming the protected minority in a non-Jewish environment. That's what she's saying. Once you go to that place and you say, I am a Zionist, and Zionism is realized by us giving up the Zionist dream, by reinterpreting the Zionist dream, by saying that what is Zion... Once you say Zionism is just a safe place for Jews... then there's no point in Israel at all whatsoever.
So how do they envision? Practically, how do they imagine?
So that's an excellent question, and it's not actually the question of this. I'm bringing this up. Right. First of all, it is to ring an alarm, but that's really the side. The point is to see, A, how frustrating it can be to try to create unity when there really are people like, you know, I could easily say, you should be unified, but I'm looking inside myself saying, how can I find a point that I agree with this lady on? Like, what could I create unity with her? And I don't see a point. I just don't. I don't know what it is. I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe we're both nice grandmas or something. I don't know. But I don't see how we could create unity, and certainly not in anything like that. Like, we're not working towards the same goal at all. In fact, we're working against each other. Really against each other. Because I don't believe that that Jews should give up sovereignty in the land of Israel. I do believe that. I mean, yeah. And not even from a Zionist perspective, from a holy perspective, from the Torah. That's our spot, and we didn't steal it from anyone. First of all, we bought most of that land. I'm curious, I would love to see a map of the percentage that we bought and the percentage that we won, like the percentage that, I would be curious just to see what does that look like, but we did buy a lot.
A lot.
Yeah, yeah. Now that's what the blue and white pushkas were. I still have Aria Leary's old JNF pushka, because it's the old classic, you know.
The metal box.
Uh-huh, yeah. It's just his yard sale.
Remember but you don't, because you weren't because you didn't until you were 12. The dime thing where you stick, we had them in Hebrew school where you stuck a dime in every week in the in a
it was
tree.
Like the shape of a tree.
It was a cardboard tree.
Yeah, it was
just like
a
cardboard
tree.
Uh-huh. And
yeah, I remember that.
Do you remember that? Yeah. Esther, you remember that?
Yeah, vaguely.
Well, there's an old JNF song when the chorus Well, I'll tell you, the song goes, I'll tell you, my son, my asaper lecha yelda, you probably hear the Hebrew, which you can, I will tell you, ha yelda v'gam lecha, and also to you, ha yelda, ech be'eretz Yisrael, how in the land of Israel, ademanig elet, how the land is redeemed, ech be'eretz Yisrael, ademanig elet, dunam pove, dunam sham, a dunam here and there, regev achar regev, kach nivde admata am, mitzafon ad negev, that's how it's redeemed from the Negev. Here, Al Hakir Tluya Kufsa, on the wall is hanging a box. Zot Kufsa Tatchelet, that's the blue box. Kol Pruta She Nechnasa, every penny you put in there. Kol Pruta She Nechnasa, Admanig Elet, land is redeemed. Kol Pruta She Nechnasa, Admanig Elet, Dunam Pove, Dunam Sham, Regev Acha Regev, Kach Nivde Admata Am, Mitzafon Ad Negev.
That's very nice.
Old songs, right?
Never heard that.
So that's the old JNF.
I vaguely.
Okay, so anyway, the point is here, once we switch, and this is the same point as Sodom, why Sodom couldn't be redeemed, because they had illegalized chesed, and they switched the laws. So once you say that's not chesed, there is no redemption. You can't. Once you change it into what's right is wrong, what's wrong is right, you can't even then see, there's no compass. It's like getting, what is that called, when the pilot flies into the ground because he thinks it's the sky.
No. She's talking horizon. About when you, oh, the, when you mix the horizon.
When you flip it, yeah, when you flip the horizon and you make him that mistake. There's a name for that.
Yeah.
That's what's so that's there's this. What is that called? Anyway, there you can do that spiritually, and that's what this is saying. Is that that's what Paro wanted was to cause that to happen spiritually, and that's what creates the entrapment. Is once you're so far gone that you can't see what's true and clear, you're done, and then you're totally trapped. You can't get out. I'll give you, for instance, just again from our library last week. So Yeshua did go, and we have a brand new library in our neighborhood, in our low income neighborhood, and it's hopefully supposed to elevate people in that neighborhood. But you walk in, and the first thing that's there, the entire first half of the floor, the bottom floor, is DVDs and video games. No books.
All right, we talked about that last week.
Looks like there's books you can see from Colfax.
Yeah, but when you walk in,
you only see
you'd see that, right? So I say they should take a lesson from the supermarkets, right? The milk is in the way back. You have to walk past all the pretty stuff to go get the milk. They have
walk back, past the books.
Put it upstairs and walk past the books to get it. Okay. So Yeshua pointed that out to the librarian and said, you know, it's concerning. You know, this is a library. We should have the
books in front.
Books in front. And so the librarian, and this is a perfect example of losing. They said, well, the videos and the they get great circulation here.
Most popular.
They're the most popular. And I thought, you have lost it.
Your point would be...
Right, it's not about circulating your items. It's about elevating people through books. Right? So the videos are a draw, but that's not the purpose. So, and once you think it's about circulating, you've lost your bearings, and you can't fix it. So, okay.
Oh, my screen. Sorry.
No problem. We'll miss you. Okay, so let's look at this then. Let's look at the first paragraph. Everything has both an inner and outer aspect. The person whose ego is attuned to externals sees only the outer aspects. In exile, for example, he sees only a nation without a land of its own, politically and economically dependent on others. A person attuned to inner truths sees the physical facts, but he sees them only as effects. The primary cause, the true cause, is the spiritual cause. The exile of Israel, in essence, is a spiritual state. It is the state of being alienated from our true selves, of being enslaved by the Yetzirah. Hakashav Sameach. In the physical world, this takes the guise of political or economic enslavement. This thought is expressed in the Haggadah when we thank God for our rescue and the redemption of our soul. So let's look at that. So we have the... This just reminds me of my concept of parallel universes. So we were talking about how do we redo our Seder? You know, all kinds of questions every year. How do you do it? And I actually am not as bothered as some people are by our Seder and, let's say, some of the lighter conversation or whatever. This, everybody has their own thing. Some people want more Divrei Torah, some people want more jokes, some people want to go faster, some people want to go slower. You know, so, but the way I deal with it is I just have a parallel universe that I live in. So when I tell that to my husband, he's like, "You are your mother's daughter." I'm like, "No, but I'm grounded in my parallel universe. Like, it's not, I have my parallel universe." So, but, and I can just, like, all the Divrei Torah that I listen to, I can just plug in no matter where we're up to. I hear it, and it's anchored in the Haggadah, whether they're talking about politics or joking, or it's a little longer, or a little more boring, or a little more kids, or a little more messy, or a little, whatever it is. I have my parallel universe, and I get to hear my the Haggadah I want to hear. So.
Does that keep you from participating when you?
So it's interesting. No. So, but it did keep me because we were talking. How should we do it differently? And one of the thoughts is somebody else should maybe lead it. Maybe the women should lead it this year. Maybe my mother-in-law, me, Sarah, and Elisheva should lead the Seder. And I thought, well, I don't want to do that because that will make it hard for me to live in my parallel universe. Then I'll have to be too much in this universe. So I told that to Uri, and he said, "How's Donnie in that parallel universe?" I said, "Well, he's not actually in it." He said, "You created a parallel universe and you didn't invite Donnie into it?" I said, "You're right. It's my parallel universe. He could be there if I want him to be." And then I said, "You know what? I think I'm going to wait till after Pesach, though, to invite him in because otherwise he's going to ruin the Seder." So, or he said, "I taught him well."
So. Sandy left him like this.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it's your
phone. I'll go take it to her.
Right. You're so nice.
If she's not back, I'll.
She'll have a Savita.
I have a feeling she'll be back, but if not.
Well, she has her sprinkler guy.
She wants to be back, that's what she wants.
Right. Right. Yep.
Give it to me.
Maybe she got in the car and got thirsty.
Thank you!
Okay, so, but anyway, I think this right here is showing the parallel universes. That's why I brought this up for this paragraph. There's the physical universe that we live in. The Jews are in exile, right? So, and he's writing this, of course, before the state. But we have this exiled Jewish people living in other people's countries and dependent on others. But we have the parallel universe is the one that we should recognize, and we want to live in both. It's a parallel universe, so we want a foot in each one. So we definitely live in our physical world, but we want to understand it from that parallel aspect that really, that's just an expression of our exile from our true selves, from our Creator, from each other. That's what exile, we're disconnected from where we're supposed to be. It's manifesting in disconnect of the Jewish people from their land. That's the physical thing that we see. But the actual thing is our disconnect from ourselves and our purpose and our Creator. Which is why today it's very confusing in the land of Israel, because we have the land, but we're still in exile. And so we still do have a disconnect from true self, from purpose, from Creator. But that's why, you know, all this conflict. But I think some of what's going on around us politically, you know, whether it's in this country, whether it's in that country, is manifestations of disconnect. How can we create unity? That's the key. That's what, there's no secret. Hashem's not keeping secrets from us. It says, get together, be one people. That's all I'm asking from you. Work together. You're my children. Join together, and this whole thing will come to an end. And we can't do it. We cannot do it. So far, we can't
do it. Well, like you say, it's one-to-one, and, you know.
Right. How do we get that? How do we make that happen? That's what I was wondering. When I'm looking at this woman, how can I create a unity with you? I don't know. But we do have this parallel universe concept that there's a spiritual and a physical, and we need to see both, what's going on in each, and how do we work with that. Okay, so that's this first concept here. Now let's look at, we don't have that much more time, but, so we talked about Paro and Mitzrayim, the unbinding. That's what Paro wants to do, is create the unbinding, and I think that's part of what, in a way... Oh, that's what I was going to talk about more at the library, is that unbinding, what you might say is freedom, it's circulating a lot, has created a boundness. You know, so I was thinking about the Barnes & Noble children's section. I think I told you about this last week, right? You go into Barnes & Noble bookstore on Colorado, go into the children's section, and it's stunning. So gorgeous. The books are laid out beautifully, little tables for kids to look at the books, and knowledgeable help to help any adult go in there and find books for every age and so great, and it's so inviting. Like, every adult, it's like a candy store of books. Like, it's just so gorgeous. Like, everything is beautiful there, right? Yes. And then I'm thinking about our library in our neighborhood. I'm thinking, I live in a parallel universe. I'm rich. I could go to Barnes & Noble and buy whatever I want for my grandchildren, you know, and I can get any help. And I know there's such a place where there's delicious books on every level to teach any concept. And I know how to access not just the place, but the person there who will guide me to find the books that I want to improve my children, to give them opportunities, to give them that leg up on the world. You know, oh, my granddaughter's already, you start, if you just say, an old house in Paris that's all you have to do, and they can say the whole thing. That was not even four yet. Covered with vines, they know the whole story, right? Mayine. I like to hear Mayine. So, and they know the reading pose. Like, you put them, even the babies, you put them in your lap, and they know how to nestle in because they're going to get a book. But they know what that is, right? So, there are people who don't know that there's that universe. You know, they walk into the library to get a DVD because it's about how can I electronically babysit these kids so I could do whatever else, right? It's not about how do you use a book to open a world. It's right. Like, we live in these two separate worlds. Like, I know there's
two. If the books were there, they'd go right to the back to get the milk.
Maybe, but the point is they're not even there. There's nobody to even give them a key to that world. And say, look, there's books. There's no enticement at all whatsoever. So there's no possibility for them to even find out that there's another universe. That's what's tragic to me.
You need to set up a reading room.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Like, here are people.
They probably have on weekends. They probably have kids reading things. Most libraries do.
But what I'm saying is, here you have a library in a low-income neighborhood that could be used to introduce people to a different world, right? And instead, it's not. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to hold it as, you know, I do want to hold it to, I want to take it to task. I'm sorry. This is what our tax dollars should be doing.
And this is a public library.
The public library that was just opened.
Making money on the people who
rent. Right, right. Who cares? Right, right, right.
Tapes or tapes rather
than, right.
Excuse me, videos.
Right. Well, they must not think these things through very well.
That's what I'm thinking. Did they sit down? So I was thinking, how is the gap, the achievement
really
gap, the gap between rich and poor and the achievement
enlarge
gap?
Enlarge those.
How well, do you help close
what
that?
What is the mission?
Yeah, what is your mission?
Is the mission to get stuff out or
just
to
have a library
or to
sell whatever?
Well, I think that mission of that library was just all politics. I don't think it had anything to do with improving our neighborhood. Not one drop. I think
so
it was about selling that piece of land and naming it after somebody that they want to name after. But otherwise, why would they put it there? They should have put it down where people could use it.
But they didn't originally have the idea of naming it after Cesar Chavez. That was
Who knows? Anyway, to me, it's tragic. You just see, like, how do people get access? That's why we're learning. That's why we know to learn. Education empowers, and it's so important. Then that's part of the Seder, is to help share the fact that there are other worlds with the people who are at the Seder. That's what we're trying to do. So we want to bring out other worlds, that it's not just this book, that this is something that belongs to us. And last week we talked about just these two words, making it from history into memory.
I wonder if there's a chief librarian of Denver.
That would be somebody to talk to.
Yeah. And ask,
that's a
can
good
I take
idea.
You on a field trip?
Yeah, because I want to go to the, let's go to Barnes & Noble and let's go there. Yeah.
I bet there is somebody who's
great
in charge
idea.
Of that stuff.
Maybe I'll do that. Anyway, we want to get this, we want to get the whole Pesach story from history.
And you have children living in that neighborhood.
Yes, I do.
That you would rather have see
absolutely.
The books.
I'll take my children to the good place. You know, that's what's so tragic about it.
I mean, so it means something if you say, I have kids that
right.
I would rather see books
right.
than videos.
Not just that, but like I have access, and that's what makes the difference between my kid and those kids. That's why my kids have a vocabulary way past the kids these kids will ever have, because they've been read to since birth.
Or before.
Yeah. And
I don't know if I want to say this or not, but you have people in our community whose children...
Uh-huh.
Or not read to.
I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that's true.
Or not read anything except for a very small slice of
probably
Judaica, Torah.
You can see. I mean, I volunteered a while.
Yeah, no, you can definitely see who's read
it. I can see it.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah. Yeah. There are kids that love to read. There are kids that can't read. They really struggle with it.
Yeah. No, it's definitely true. Right, no, but the point is...
It's sad. It's really sad.
They're not living a parallel universe. We have people in our community who don't live a parallel universe.
There's at least no time to do this.
Right. Working does cost. Part of it is working.
Yeah,
it is. It's not free.
I know.
It is not free.
And large families.
Yeah, it is not free. Yeah. Anyway, so let's just talk about one more point here. Okay, so spirit. So we're talking about this. Pesach is the time of our freedom. So we're not referring just to the past event, but every year the Jewish soul has access to this special influx of spiritual freedom. So we have to know that. This is a time when Hashem skipped over our prerequisites and brought us out, even though we didn't deserve to come out. He took us out anyway based on a promise. And this is a time that we have access to that spiritual energy. We can come out of whatever is binding us. That's our opportunity, is to think, what do I want to get out of right now? You know, is there something that's holding me back? Is there an attitude? Is there an anger? Is there a frustration? Is there a laziness? Is there something that I feel entrapped by? I can come out, even if I don't do all the work. I can set my mind on that and jump out of it. That's part of the simanim for the Seder, Kadesh. Jump right into Kedusha. Jump right up to the spot you want to be. And then, Ur Chatz. Did we talk about that last time? You know, the simanim, the signs of the Seder. There's 15 signs, mm-hmm. right? The second one is the only one that has an and. Kadesh Ur Chatz, only one with a vav. Kadesh and wash your hands, right? Everything I could say, and Yachatz, and Magid, and it doesn't. It's just those, so they must be a pair if it's Kadesh Ur Chatz. Somehow they go together, and each one else is their own separate thing. So Rabbi Rosner in one of his shiurim says, one aspect of the two together is that here is the time where you get to jump straight into Kedusha, and afterwards, you wash up the messes that you... You don't have to first clean up before you create what you want. You first create what you want, and then you do the cleanup work. Kadesh and wash, right?
Not make it holy.
Make it holy, and then take care of like the stuff you got to do. But first, jump right in.
Which kind of is...
That's the opposite of how we usually do it, right? Yeah. First, you want to clean up. You want to make a clean slate. And then you want to jump in and do your thing. Then make your thing happen. So, but in the Seder, so Pesach, that's what Pesach is about. Passing over how ready you are to come out of Mitzrayim.
Although we do say Kiddush and then wash.
Kadesh or Chatz, right. We do.
I mean, but on Shabbos.
Right, right. That's a different washing. This washing is not rachtza, it's urchatz.
Right.
So this washing is actually a special
washing.
It's without the bracha. Mm-hmm. But this special washing, and some people say, why are we even doing it? We don't need to do this washing at all. This is a washing that just reminds us of Beis HaMikdash times when people used to wash before they eat a wet fruit or vegetable. So here we are eating a wet vegetable. We're dipping into the salt water, and that's why you should dip with your fingers, not a fork. Because we washed for this. You should take your whatever you're dipping and dip it right with your fingers in so you're eating that wet thing with your newly washed hands. Because we are keeping that law of tahara once a year. We don't wash other times. Some people, I have seen some people like, let's say grapes. You wash grapes in the summertime, right? And they're wet. You're not drying each grape. Some people will wash to eat those grapes. I think part of it's because they're one of the fruits of the land of Israel. And they're all wet. And some people just, based on the fact that you do transfer tumma through the water, they some people will wash for that. But it's not the common thing at all. People don't. Like, that's just not a thing. We don't do that. But the Seder is when we say, God went above and beyond for us. He did a ton of stuff to take us out. All the plagues, all the helping, all the miracles, all the wonders. We're going to talk about it all night long. Let's do a little extra thing for him, too. We so don't need to wash right now. We don't have the temple. We don't need it at all. But let's just start the evening by saying, I'm going to go that extra half a mile, you know, and just say, Hashem, I get there's lots of laws. I don't keep it all the time. But on this night, when I'm discussing all the extra you did for me, I'm going to do that little extra for you too, or Chatz. I'm going to wash it this time when it's totally not necessary, but it's just part of the larger plan to remember the Kedusha of that time. Okay, there's so much. I just want to say one more thing and then we'll close up. So what is freedom? So what Rav Dessler talks about here, this is a very important concept. What is freedom? And so we talked a little bit about loosening the bounds in that binds you up. So really then that gives us a clue into the opposite effect will release us. So if we tie ourselves to the Torah, tie ourselves to Jewish law, and we do create restrictions, that does create a freedom. Right? So, for instance, just like, and let's use our library mashal again, or what happens to the kids in the community, those people who are required, do your homework, go to bed, eat nutritious. Okay, that's being bound up. No, you can't eat that now. No, you must brush your teeth now. No, it's time to go to bed. No, you can't watch that now. No, you must read that now. No, you must finish that before you go play, right? No, you must go outside to play. You've seen enough screen time. All those restrictions create freedom. They do create freedom because in the end you have an educated, empowered young adult, hopefully, that understands how to eat and how to sleep and how to educate and how to limit themselves in order to create more freedom. And like, how do you use this world to make it work for you? But that requires a lot of restrictions. It does. So that's what the Torah is about. Let me tell you how to operate in this world. And if you do these things and skip those things, you will get to greater freedom. That's what it's about. So that's what's real freedom, occupying oneself with the Torah. And he points out here, occupying, la'asok b'divrei Torah, not lilmod Torah.
Not learning.
Learning is important. It is to learn, but to engage in it. So that's to learn, to do, to make your
learning,
entire life.
Living, and applying.
That's right. Learning, living, and applying. That's what it is. Not just learning in a vacuum, because that would be a mistake of just learning. It's got to be learning, living, and applying. And that's what a ben Torah is. And that's what creates real freedom, is if somebody's really engaged in the Torah all the time, that makes one's life free. And if one forgets that, to the extent that one forgets that their whole life is revolving around learning, living, and applying the Torah, then they can easily become slaves to other little bits and pieces. Sometimes it's little bits and pieces. How I look, how I drive, how I whatever, that can enslave, and sometimes bigger pieces, but the Torah can free you from that only if we see those things like chametz, where we have to get out every last little speck. That's what it is. So that's what we're doing right now, is sweeping away the chametz from our lives, sweeping away that bit of ego, or that lot of ego, whatever we have. Chametz is, the difference between chametz and matzah is hot air, right? And so that's our ego. It's the same ingredients, just one puffs up, one has pride, and one does not. So matzah is the prideless, and bread is the prideful, which we're allowed to eat all year round. But right now, while we're trying to totally connect to Hashem, and make our history into memory, make it active inside of us, this is who I am, this is what powers me, this is how I grow in the world, that's when we want to be able to say, ego has to go, I make space for Hashem in my life. Okay, that's it. Everybody should have a Chag Kasher Sameach.